Tonight on Banfield, the million-dollar quadruple murder investigation in Idaho. 10 days in, zero suspects. Where is the monster who killed four college kids? Also ahead, can the dead students' vehicles solve the case? Can the Wi-Fi at their house drop a digital trail? Physical evidence is great, but our gadgets now see everything, and they can catch killers too. And then he is still on the run, or perhaps he is hiding in plain sight. Police say he could be anywhere and he could still pose a threat. But maybe, maybe none of that is true. Maybe the Idaho butcher isn't a he at all. We'll check our assumptions and the odds. It's a woman with an expert in the craft. And later, the crime solvers next door and across the country and around the world. Anywhere there's internet, there are cyber sleuths workshopping theories on the Idaho killings, spotting details that maybe police missed. And they are talking to us straight ahead on this special hour of Banfield. Hello and welcome to this special hour of the coverage of the Idaho college murders. Tonight, millions of people across this country are traveling home to be with family and friends for Thanksgiving tomorrow. But we know four kids who won't be. Those University of Idaho students who were brutally stabbed to death here as they slept at this off-campus home. Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. No flights for them. No trains. No road trips home. It is day 10 of the sweeping investigation into their mysterious murders. And earlier today, police let us all know just how this investigation is going. Bottom line, not well. That is not a quote by any means, but the message was unmistakable. Still no arrests, no identified suspects. In fact, more people ruled out as suspects. And a fresh plea to the campus and to the city and to anyone else who might have information or maybe video that they could share with the police. They are still asking for the public's help, even after receiving 1,000 tips so far. As for the most tantalizing and consistent detail that police have made public to date, the killings were somehow targeted. They are still convinced of that, and they are still refusing to say why.
We don't want to put our investigation in jeopardy by releasing what we have. There's always a balance between what you're willing to release versus what you're trying to gather.
But here's the new information they did decide to release today. They have gathered 103 pieces of evidence from that home. They have taken 4,000 photographs of the crime scene and done multiple 3D scans as well. They've conducted 150 interviews and have now fully cleared the additional kids who came to that house on the Sunday morning after the murders. They have also cleared Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, who received 10 phone calls from Kaylee and her best friend, Madison, right before those two roommates were killed. It is through social media that we've been able to better understand what might have happened to those four students and the lives that those four students were living. Two of the victims, Maddie Mogan and Zana Kernodle, both worked at a restaurant called the Mad Greek, and the staff there posted this message on Facebook. Our deepest sympathies go out to all of the friends and families of Zana and Maddie, Ethan and Kaylee. We've been able to map out that Madison and Kaylee had third floor bedrooms at 1122 King Road. You can see through the bedroom window Madison's pink cowboy boots just beyond the deck rail that runs along the back of the house. And in that photo, you can see where Maddie is wearing those pink boots in happier times. There's also that large M that you can see in Maddie's bedroom window. And from TikTok, you can see that Kaylee had the sliding glass door in her third floor bedroom, top floor of the house, right beside her best friend, Maddie, which would mean that Zana and her boyfriend, Ethan, must have been the two on the second floor in the bedroom on the right-hand side of the house if you're looking from that parking lot. We've circled it there for you. The reason we circled it is because this is also the evidence from that bedroom. It was so filled with blood that that blood seeped out and onto the foundation down below. Authorities are refusing to say if the killer ever set foot on the bottom floor of that house where the two surviving roommates were asleep. Roommates who we believe honored their lost friends with brand new matching tattoos that show the victim's initials, M, K, X, and E. And the caption on this post reads, Maddie, Kayla, Zanna, and Ethan, love you always and forever. Their angel wings are presumably in honor of Madison, Maddie, who had that very same tattoo on her left arm. Here she is pictured, obviously, before she died. The angel wings. Well, that's important. It is the unofficial symbol of Maddie and Zanna's sorority, Pi Beta Phi. Also tonight, it is very possible that these two surviving roommates were safely locked behind their bedroom doors because a famed detective from the O.J. Simpson days, Mark Furman, who now lives in Idaho, has said publicly that after speaking with a student, quote, their story was they heard partying, they heard noise, but they, as usual, said there's partying going on and they locked the door. In fact, neighbors have said that house was a party house, but so, in fact, was the whole neighborhood. Detectives say they're working 14 to 18 hours a day, and the chief is now concerned about the mental health of his own officers. But despite the long hours, they still have precious few answers. News Nation's correspondent Kelly Beeson is covering the story, and she joins me now live. You know, Kelly, I know you were watching that press conference right alongside me, and I mean, honestly, they gave a lot less information than I expected them to give after 2 days of no press conference at all.
Yeah, I can understand your feelings, Ashley, and I think those are shared by so many. Everyone wants answers, and, you know, we're always looking for a suspect in this case, or maybe more details pointing to who the suspect or suspects may be, but we didn't get that today. Instead, what we received was who law enforcement is ruling out and also some of the resources they're putting behind this investigation. Here's an overview.
103 pieces of individual evidence. We took approximately 4,000 photographs. We've conducted multiple 3D scans of the residence, and we have hundreds of hours used by technicians and investigators, including our forensics team and detectives from multiple agencies.
Police saying today that the investigation into the murders of four University of Idaho students is progressing. Law enforcement conducting 150 interviews and processing more than 1,000 tips. Among them, that 21-year-old Kaylee Gonzalez had a stalker.
We have heard mention that Kaylee stated she may have had a stalker. Detectives have been looking into that and to this point have been unable to corroborate the statement, although we continue to seek information and tips regarding that report.
One of Gonzalez's sisters saying on Cuomo last week that Kaylee had no messy past with another man.
There's nothing. There's no boy problem. There's no threat. There's no high-risk lifestyle that could have indicated this.
Law enforcement maintained that Gonzalez and her roommates, Madison Mogan and Zanna Kernodle, plus Kernodle's boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, were targeted. That conclusion reportedly from evidence on the scene. And the fact that two other roommates and a dog were not harmed in the attack early Sunday morning, November 13th.
We do not believe the following individuals were involved. The two surviving roommates, the male seen in a grub truck video circulating on the internet, a private party who drove Kaylee and Madison home, any of the individuals who spoke to the dispatcher on the 911 call. We're also aware of a male whom Madison and Kaylee had called several times the morning of November 13th, and we do not suspect that individual.
Police say they're still looking for a fixed blade knife and are going through large files of surveillance footage from the community.
And police also not ruling out the potential of more than one suspect in this case. Ashley.
Kelly, what I thought was fascinating was they spent a lot of time talking about that stalker issue, saying that they haven't been able to corroborate it, but they said they're still looking. That was interesting. They didn't say it's a dead issue.
They certainly didn't. And they were very careful with their language. I listened to this press conference twice just to make sure we got it right. Police saying Kaylee may have said she had a stalker, and police saying directly, we are not done looking into that piece of information. So leaving the door open, certainly, Ashley.
Yeah, interesting. A reporter actually said, why did you even look into it? And they said, because one of their interviews had yielded that that information. All right, Kelly Beeson, thank you. And have a good Thanksgiving with your family. Hug them close.
Thank you. You as well, Ashley.
Thank you. Lauren Patterson is a reporter for Northwest Public Broadcasting and Spokane Public Radio. She was at today's briefing, and she asked one of the more probing questions of the police. And I have to say, Lauren, I thought the answer was distressing. Thank you for being on the show. You asked about the Wi-Fi in that home, maybe hotspots in that home, and if police had actually tried to connect a killer's phone that may have linked up unknowingly. And the answer was absolutely perplexing. Tell me what it was they said to you and how they answered you.
Well, they started by pointing out that, yes, the FBI has created a special webpage to receive social and digital media tips. It's fbi.gov/Moscow, Idaho. But these are Gen Z victims with many young friends all using technology. So as you know, footprints aren't always just left on the floor of a house. We leave digital footprints, too, every time we search online or connect to one of our friends' Wi-Fi. So hopefully there's some young tech-savvy people on the force looking into the digital aspects of this.
I mean, this is a big thing, you know. Not everybody understands that their phone might hook up to a Wi-Fi in a house where they've been before. They might not realize they hook up to a hotspot, and that would be a wealth of knowledge if the police are actually doing that. I've got some forensics experts and an FBI expert coming up. I'm going to ask about that, too. Let me ask you, Lauren, about the mood in that room, because those reporters have been there, many of them, for 10 days, and they have been asking these questions and getting a lot of brick walls. Talk about what was happening off camera, what the reporters were all talking about amongst themselves.
I would say the last press conference was quite a bit busier. There were way more national and local reporters in the room. This time around, there were fewer people overall. I think people have left town, honestly, for the holiday weekend. And I do think the national reporters are a little more impatient, maybe, than those of us who are local. I live 5 minutes from the venue, so I can just go home afterwards and chill. But I think a lot of people are maybe tired of waiting around in town for something to happen. But those of us who are local, we know how to be patient. It's kind of like time passes a little slower here, you know?
I have about 20 seconds left. I got to ask you about this. They will not release that 911 call. They will not release the transcript, Lauren. Why is that?
Well, we don't know if anything on the call has anything to do with the theory that the suspects are targeted. I know it's hard sometimes because we're in the age of social media. We're used to instant gratification. We want all the details. We want to know everything. But we have to remember that if this crime is solved, eventually we are going to have all the answers. So instead of speculating, this is just going to be an exercise in patience.
Lauren Patterson, you're terrific for joining us, and I appreciate your patience in covering this story. I'd really like to have you back. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so police did officially confirm for the first time today that a few more people who were once maybe considered suspects are no longer considered suspects. The friends who came over to the house before the police even did on the morning that the bodies were found, they're ruled out now. And Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, Jack DeCur, who Kaylee and Maddie had called 10 times right before they died. Joining me now is Mark Lungarello, who's been covering the story for the New York Post. I wanted to ask you, Mark, look, New York Post gets a lot of breaks and a lot of lead stories. Were you surprised at that press conference today? I expected to hear something, anything. And really, it was more a plea to all of us to help the police.
Yes. Yeah, I think a lot of people were expecting a lot more. But I do think that this has just been kind of how the police have been reacting in the last few days, that they're going to keep, you know, regular communication with media and the public, because there were so many questions early on and there was so much confusion that, yes, I don't think that there was a huge break today necessarily, but I think it was just indicative of the local police kind of trying to keep everybody informed and in the loop.
Let me ask you about that incident in Salem, Oregon. We reported on it last night. A couple was stabbed a year ago in their beds. One survived, one died. It was approximately the same time 2, 3, 4 in the morning, sometime in that window. And it was interesting. A reporter asked about that in the press conference today and got a fascinating answer. They actually got a tip on that and they're investigating. Do you see any connection at all? Anything else that might make this more significant of a lead for the police?
Well, that's interesting because, again, I think that they don't want to rule out anything. But certainly there's a lot of similarities in the two cases, right? But it's also a situation where perhaps the other case is a situation of an intruder or something having gone wrong. And they continue to say that they believe that it's targeted. So whatever evidence that they're not sharing with us in the University of Idaho case, they're clearly seeing something there that they think it's not a part of, you know, random killings or random connections to other cases. There's something there that they're seeing and they're not sharing with us. And, you know, even you said earlier about the 911 call. They spoke to multiple people in that initial 911 call, which originated from within the house. I'm sure that there may be some details about how the bodies were found or what happened on those calls that they might want to keep from the public, because right now only the killer and the investigators know that.
So let me ask you this, Mark. I got about 30 seconds left, but I also parsed the words of the police when they said anyone who spoke with the 911 dispatcher has been cleared. What if there were some friends in the house that morning that didn't have a chance to speak with the dispatcher? They didn't say all of the friends. They said anyone who spoke with the dispatcher. Did that stand out to you?
It did. And we looked at the floor plans of the house, and we've all been kind of speculating how an intruder could have gotten in. That sliding glass door on the second floor obviously being one of the main doors that we're all looking at here. But the question remains, was it a forced entry? Was the person let in? Was the person, someone that they were acquainted with who may have been in the house? We don't really know the answer to that. And the cops have certainly withheld that from us as part of the investigation. So, yes, it stuck out certainly when they said it. But like I keep going back to, we don't really know what happened in there. So we're not really entirely sure how it played out.
Mark Langarello, thank you. I appreciate you being here tonight. We'll have you back next week. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to bring in Chris Swecker. He is the former assistant director of the FBI. He's also an attorney and probably one of the best crime-fighting minds that I have worked with in my long career. All right, Chris, listen. That question that the reporter asked about the Wi-Fi and the hotspot, had the police or the FBI or any authorities looked into all the activity on the Wi-Fi or maybe hotspots in that house? Because that might actually link to a phone that's curious. Do you think that the authorities in that small community, I get it, they've had one murder in 7 years, or not had a murder in 7 years, and also the FBI field offices out there, do you think that they have this kind of technical savvy to be right on that and be looking at it from day one?
Local department, probably not. State police, maybe. The FBI, as a whole, as an agency, yes, they certainly have that capability at their, at the headquarters level and out at the field and certain field offices. And, it's really a question of imagination, too. You know, the technical capabilities are there, but you have to be able to think of these sort of things. As you and I were talking about offline here, there's so many different types of digital evidence and communication modes and that sort of thing. That, in this era, we talked about Apple Watches, we talked about other types of Alexa, things that you have, apps that you have on in your laptop or your mobile device that upload into the cloud and store things, geolocations and that sort of thing. So I haven't heard much about digital evidence in this case, and that makes you wonder how aggressively they are pursuing that angle.
It fascinates me, Chris. If I have an Apple Watch and it will alert 911 if I fall down. It will tell everyone when my heart stops, which could be phenomenal information when four victims die in one episode. It could tell you exactly when each, person died, or at least anyone who might have been wearing one of these watches if they were. And then the Alexa. How many times has it happened to you if you have one in your house where you're having a normal conversation and all of a sudden Alexa kicks on and you haven't even said her name? That records, whatever you say records, and it goes to the cloud and it can be accessed by authorities. Do enough authorities know this stuff to be looking for those devices and then digging deep into the devices for the critical data?
Not enough, no. I mean, that digital evidence thing, that type of evidence is often overlooked, or you just don't have the capabilities or the imagination to even think of that type of evidence. So, you know, it's a very specialized area. There aren't enough technicians and analysts and techs with the police departments, especially. And as you go up, each state agency, each state has an investigative agency. There, it's the state police. Other places, it's a Bureau of Investigation, local Bureau of Investigation. The FBI, without a doubt, has that capability. NSA, the CIA. But I go back to this notion of imagination, of investigative, acumen, if you will, to know that type of evidence is out there. Hear a lot of talk about traditional evidence there.
We hear a lot about traditional. We don't hear so much about the newfangled stuff that maybe people didn't know about or didn't exist 10 years ago. So I got to ask you, I got 30 seconds left, but they keep saying that they have evidence that it's a targeted attack. What kind of evidence could possibly exist in a crime scene like that might actually make an investigator think it's a targeted attack? Just give me like the top five. What kinds of things would it be?
I think a lot of times you'll see one victim with more wounds than another, more savage type of wounds, more disfigurement and that sort of thing. And I hate to get that clinical. These are people, these are students, they're precious lives. But from a clinical sense, I think that's where this is coming from, is that it's a very messy crime scene. A knife is a tough way to kill somebody. It's a brutal way to kill somebody. Somebody came into the house and maybe went directly to certain rooms. If there were footprints and, bloody footprints or even muddy, snowy footprints in there, you could trace the path of the killer and see that they made a beeline for one room or another and didn't just meander around. So those are the top two that I would throw in.
Fascinating. And of course, there is the digital footprint. What about emails and texts? What about financial transactions? We're going to dig into that in a little bit. Hey, Chris Wecker, thank you for doing this tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ashley. Take care.
A full 8 days after the murders on King Road in Idaho, police have now expanded the murder scene way out back from the home. And they were even seen digging through the woods for clues. Could it be that the answers are actually outside the house? And should the police have started looking there much, much sooner? Our forensic experts are going to weigh in next. Welcome back to our special coverage of the mysterious murders in Idaho. Four university students all stabbed as they slept 10 days ago. That means for 10 days, investigators have been sifting through the evidence, and that is a very long time to process a murder scene. But when authorities faced reporters today for the third time since the murders occurred, they really didn't have much to say. Certainly no breakthroughs. Idaho's governor has committed $1 million to this case. But again, 10 days, no arrests, no suspects named. I'm joined by Dr. Larry Koblinski. He's a renowned DNA scientist and a professor emeritus of forensic science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And Gabe Hampkian is a forensics DNA expert and the founder and director of the Idaho Innocence Project, whose DNA work helped exonerate Amanda Knox. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for being here. Larry, I want to begin with you. This is a very messy scene. We have heard from many sources that there is a lot of blood and a lot of evidence. I have to ask you, from your expertise, is it possible in a crime scene to have too much blood and too much DNA? Because there were a lot of people that came in and out of this house. It was a party house, and there are former tenants in this house as well.
Sure, it gets more complicated. This is a complex scene. There's no question about it. There are people that were in the house that have nothing to do with the crime itself. And those people, there will be DNA collected from them. They will have elimination specimens. And they will freely give up their saliva, their buccal swabs, to provide their DNA. They have to just be eliminated. Because once you look at all of the evidence and you generate genetic profiles, you have to know what's important and what's not. So it can be complicated. If there's a lot of blood, it's easy to track blood all over the scene. It's easy to contaminate it. This is a complicated situation. But there's a lot more than just blood and DNA. There's fingerprints that are very important. And remember, we have to be focused, at least initially, on the point of entry and the point of exit. The person who did this had to come in some way. And there aren't very many points of entry that are accessible to somebody. There are trace evidence experts. There's blood spatter experts. There's a lot of different kinds of analysis that needs to be made given a complicated situation like this. There are two ways of actually identifying somebody from evidence, and that's fingerprints and DNA analysis. So you could very well turn up the name of somebody through this kind of procedure.
Just can't imagine how hard it would be to track down all the people who've been in and out of that house for the parties and the fun and the tenants over the years to make sure that they're eliminated from the samples that they may end up finding from the killer. Greg, let me get you in on this. Having worked on the Amanda Knox case, it's eerie. I know it's different, but again, it involved a stabbing. It was very mysterious. DNA played a huge role in it. There was a small town. The people there were very impatient to get results, and Amanda was wrongfully convicted. I'm wondering if you see any parallels or any concerns in the way this case is progressing.
Yeah, there's a lot of eerie parallels, as you said, and we have another case in Idaho that I worked on, which is the Angie Dodge murder, and Christopher Tapp that was incarcerated 20 years wrongfully for that murder. We helped the police find the man who confessed and who matches the DNA. In both of those cases, young women killed in their bedrooms, deep gashes to the neck, and a rush to find evidence to arrest a suspect. And we had huge mistakes made. And in the Angie Dodge murder in Idaho Falls, they took DNA from over 100 people. They didn't take DNA from Mr. Drips, who lived across the street, who could see into Angie's window from his house, who had no alibi for the time he was missing. The police interviewed him. They didn't have DNA. He could have been compared originally to it. So if I had any advice to the very hardworking people there on the ground, anytime they interview somebody, take a swab. And that can just quickly eliminate them, even if they're not considered the prime suspect. The problem
is so
these
incredibly
kind of,
critical.
Yeah. Looking for a motive might be too early for all of us. The evidence, it's in 103 samples they took. Somebody's DNA is there. I'm going to guess that the perpetrator's DNA is there, and they'll be able to ID somebody.
It's hard to stab four people without getting some blood on your hand, and that becomes slippery, and it is easy to cut yourself, especially when some are fighting back, as we learned from the coroner. Listen, Larry, I've only got about 45 seconds left, but the cars that are parked out front, the kids' cars that are still left behind, I'm curious about the GPS information that might be contained in some of these newer vehicles. Wherever those kids drove to, whoever they visited prior to these killings, wouldn't you need to get those cars to a specialized garage so that you could actually take the GPS information from them to discover what the tracks were of the kids before they died?
I think that's absolutely correct. Again, we're talking digital evidence here. And along with the cars, there's the videotapes. They're looking for a video, any place they can get it. Of course, it's not like New York City where you've got cameras on every building, so you can't escape being on video. But this in Moscow, they will try to get as much video as they can. They're going to go through the cell phones, their computers, their text messages, their
communication. Oh, and they've already solicited all of the Ring doorbell cams from the neighborhood, but one reporter said there's only about 7 in that particular area. I have to cut it there, but thank you to both of you, Larry Kublinski and Greg Hempikian. Really appreciate your insights tonight.
Sure.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Still to come, murder is a nasty business, any kind of murder, and the Idaho murders are as nasty as it gets. But does that necessarily make it the handiwork of a man? We refer to the killer, almost any killer, as he without even thinking about it. But should we? Should we think about it? Could it in fact be a woman? That theory when we come back. See, I always say he In almost all of the crimes that I've covered over 35 years, it's always, did he leave fingerprints? How did he gain access to the house? Did investigators find his shoe print? And it is no different this time covering a case in Idaho. But have I jumped to conclusions? Could the Idaho butcher possibly be a woman? We have seen female serial killers before, like this woman, Eileen Wuornos. She was a prostitute who shot seven of her clients dead. And then, of course, there was... Yeah, I'm struggling here, too. Because there just aren't a whole lot of famous female serial killers, are there? Nor mass killers. And I know what you're thinking. When it comes to the Idaho case, a killer this violent, this gruesome, and this aggressive, stabbing four adults to death, how could that be a she? First, there's the sheer strength that this kind of brutality would take. And then there are those statistics. A recent study put the number of female mass murderers at just 7%. But our women's prisons are brimming with violent, troubled criminals, murderers among them. In fact, the DOJ says 11% of murders are committed by women. Just not the kind of murders that happened in that house in Idaho. But why is that? Great question. And a very smart reporter today asked that question at the news conference of the police. Take a listen.
Also, you mentioned that the analysis unit is here. Will we be able to hear anything from them about a working profile they possibly have? And on that note, have you guys ruled out the possibility that the killer might be a female?
So we look at every avenue. We're looking at every group of people.
Police really didn't answer that. It didn't seem to me, anyway, that it really occurred to them. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But I'm joined now by former Louisiana homicide detective Rodney Demery, who now hosts the podcast Murder Chose Me. Rod, you think this killer might, in fact, be a woman. When the odds are completely stacked against that theory, why do you think that?
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me. Yeah, you know, it's very likely it could be a female. The type of crime... I think the thought is that it's a mass murderer, maybe some sort of serial killer. But the reality is it sounds like a passionate crime to me. I think it was someone that had a rage, a certain passion to create such violence. The assumption, the wrong assumption, is that that could be a male. More than likely, it's a female or a same-sex type relationship or something along those lines.
I mean, 93% of the, you know, mass killers in the last 15 years have been men. And then there's that physicality. Think about it. Ethan is a very tall, very big boy. It would take a lot, even a sleeping man, to make sure that he's killed before having to take on four others. To that end, do you think that the killer planned to kill four, or maybe planned to kill two and two others were collateral damage because... maybe they woke up or he realized he'd been seen or she realized she's been seen?
Well, I think a likely scenario is just someone with a surprise attack. Now, I've worked several murder cases where females have attacked males and successfully done so. The sheer shock of being attacked violently kind of disables people. Sometimes they just can't react. So I wouldn't rule that out. Now, that's not to say that this is, you know, 100% a woman, but I think it would be a terrible mistake to think that it wasn't.
To that end, do you think a lot of women get away with murder? Because just like me, I usually think it's a man, and so do authorities.
Yeah, I think women, not necessarily do they get away with it, but I think it's probably a delay, you know, because the first thought or the first assumption is a male. And that suspect can actually avoid detection for quite a while.
Rod, one of the things I've been noticing, and of course, look, it's the age of social media, and, you know, girls in college are all over social media, and these girls had so much social media. They're beautiful. They've got beautiful vehicles. You know, Kaylee bought a Range Rover. She was expecting to start a new job, you know, in the new year. Do you think there's a potential for jealousies because of this? And that's maybe why police should be looking towards other women who see these lives that they think are so much better than theirs?
I think that's a real possibility. Social media obviously creates some sort of violence, but I think it's more likely a relationship type crime. And I think the police probably have a pretty good indication who it is. I just think they're not speaking about it.
10 seconds left. Any chance it's just the boogeyman. It's just the Jeffrey Dahmers of the world. It's just the Ted Bundys. What do you think of that?
I would say probably not. It's definitely someone within their close inner circle.
Rod Demery, thank you. Thank you for being on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, the victim's social media. I mentioned it. The trail is well-traveled, and it is a source of clues in this case. But what about their Venmo accounts? Did any suspicious money change hands the night the kids died? The cyber sleuths are following that trail, and we'll check their latest theories and possible leads when we come back. Thank you, Chris. 10 days after four university students were slashed to death in their beds, the police in Moscow, Idaho, have one word, one message for a public that's desperate for answers. And their message is this: help. After hundreds of tips and dozens of interviews, bags of physical evidence, police still need the public's help to find the killer. And they're getting it, especially on social media, where crime-solving groups are popping up nightly, analyzing clues and highlighting theories. My next two guests see them all. Christine Cameron and Alina Smith oversee the University of Idaho Murders Case Discussion Group on Facebook, and about 13,500 people have joined and counting, and they are here with me live. Christine, let me begin with you. You've been passionate about, you know, solving crime since JonBenet and Madeline McCann. So let me ask you about your group members zeroing in on Venmo and the public activity that they've been able to see between these victims and what they've been spending their money on. Can you explain what they've seen?
Yes. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having us. You see a lot of normal transactions between friends and roommates, paying each other for pizza and coffee. We see that on November 12th at 1:59, Ethan sent Kaylee money. The caption said, thank you. Then at 2:10 p.m., he sent her money again with a note that says, yeah, yeah, yeah. But when group members looked at Ethan's Venmo, a new Jack came about. Ethan paid someone named Jack Katovich at 11:40 p.m., and that is his last Venmo transaction. Not to say there's anything wrong or suspicious, but that's just a new character that comes for people to talk about on social media. But someone went a step further in our group and did some digging. They posted that someone paid Jack's sister that day and captioned it 3:30 a.m. That time they felt was really unsettling. And Jack K was also the first person to donate to a memorial fund for Ethan in the amount of $6. And people are really reading into that a lot. Why $6? Now Jack is really just a topic of conversation and people want to hear more about
wow.
it.
And a 3:30 a.m. Venmo captioned 3:30 a.m. Jack's sister. Fascinating. Alina, can you weigh in on why a lot of people in the discussion group have been focusing in on the potential target as actually being Zanna and Ethan, not necessarily where all the focus is on Kaylee and Maddie?
Hi, Ashley. Mostly because there's an eerily similar murder that happened in Oregon about August, and it also happened on the 13th. And it was a man and wife couple that was attacked. The murder weapon was a knife. It happened between 2 and 3 in the morning. And they believe that Kaylee and Madison were just collateral damage, and everybody has it backwards. There's a theory that migrated from a Reddit group that someone may have just followed Zanna and Ethan home from the Sigma Chi party, and they were the ones that were intended for the murders.
Christine, I have a couple seconds left, but tell me about the general consensus when it comes to the surviving roommates, Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk.
So, you know, there's two camps. Some say that they believe police, you know, they believe the police when they say that they've been cleared. Others say, you know, this delayed 911 call, the locked doors, calling friends over before they called the police, just seems way too suspicious.
What you have been doing is absolutely fascinating, ladies, and I would love to have you back next week as well, because clearly this story is not going away. And for our viewers out there, we have a link on our NewsNation Facebook page to Christine and Alina's page. It's called the University of Idaho Murders Case Discussion Group. So make sure you check that out. Christine Cameron, Alina Smith, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Night.
In my long career covering crime, I have seen social media solve cases and make really important discoveries, like in this case, Chris Watts. you remember him, the Colorado father who murdered his pregnant wife and their two little girls, dumping their tiny bodies into oil tanks? It just so happens we have news that broke today on Chris Watts. You will not believe what he's been up to in prison. That's next. This Thanksgiving, as Americans gather around the table to have a meal with their loved ones, I would like to ask you a personal favor. Can you please let them know that you watch our network and that you watch our show? In this polarized country, we here at News Nation are dedicated to taking the opinion and the bias out of the news. And good luck finding that elsewhere in cable news. So as you discuss all the important topics with your family, please go easy on everybody. And do let them know that we are here for them as well, for all America. Who knows, it actually might make future Thanksgivings a little nicer if they start watching the same news that you do. And to that end, tomorrow night, we at this network are taking a rare and honest look at the people who make your Thanksgiving dinner possible, the American farmers. News Nation's brand new documentary film, Harvest, debuts at 8, 7 Central right here on Thanksgiving night. So before the break, I mentioned Chris Watts, the American monster, who's in a maximum security prison tonight where he is more than likely to spend the rest of his life. That's his sentence. In 2018, he killed his pregnant wife, Shanann Watts, and their two little daughters, stuffing their tiny bodies into oil tanks in Colorado. Apparently, his filthy crimes have not stopped several women around America from sending him sexy pictures. A prison source tells People magazine that Watts sends racy letters back to them, too, and so forth. They think he's handsome, and they think he's misunderstood. That's not something his fellow inmates think, though. Apparently, he is so hated as a baby killer in prison that he has to remain in protective custody. But here is a message to Chris Watts tonight. You may have some skin pics on your wall sent to you by women with really bad judgment. But Chris Watts, that is the closest you are ever going to come to any kind of human contact like that again. And for the rest of us, that might be a small semblance of justice after what you did to your family. Coming up next, Chris Cuomo with a word of thanks and a special Friendsgiving episode. Stay tuned. He's next. And happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Please hug your loved ones close.